Hello, why don't we get started? I'd like to welcome everybody who's here in person and everyone who is listening to our live broadcast on www.sechistorical.org to the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society's 8th annual meeting. The Society was founded in 1999 as a nonprofit institution to preserve and share SEC and securities history. While separate and independent from the SEC, the Society is grateful for its strong and sustained relationship with the SEC and proud to host its annual meeting here today. Last week, our virtual museum and archive of the SEC and securities industry at the web address I just gave celebrated the 5th anniversary of its founding on June 1st, 2002. More than 5,000 people each month visit and use the virtual museum, which is free and accessible worldwide at all times. I encourage you to visit the museum on a regular basis and see what we add each month and to use the many rich resources available to you. After today's broadcast, our annual meeting program, Beyond Borders, a New Approach to the Regulation of Global Securities Offerings, will join the more than 30 online programs already in the museum. The audio will be available immediately. A transcript will be ready later this summer. And I'm proud to announce that all of our programs, including this one, can now be accessed as a podcast. So you can put that on your iPod on the ride home. My fellow trustees and I are appreciative of the continuing support that SEC Chairman Christopher Cox has given to our work since becoming the SEC's 28th chairman in 2005. In time for our annual meeting last year, he made possible the public display of our James Landis bust on long-term loan to the SEC, which you can see in the foyer outside the auditorium. I'm happy to announce that Chairman Cox has now given his approval for a display of historic photos from our virtual museum and archive to be placed in the SEC Visitor Center starting in mid-July. This display will be one of the activities that the SEC Historical Society will conduct to help commemorate the SEC's upcoming 75th anniversary in 2009. I'd like now to introduce David Martin, the Society's president-elect and moderator for our program today, Beyond Borders, a New Approach to the Regulation of Global Securities Offerings. David?
Thank you, Herb, very much. I'm pleased to be moderating this program for two reasons. First, I believe in the mission of the Society to deliver things of value, programs and papers, to a better understanding of the SEC's role, past and future, in the capital markets of the world. And secondly, I'm proud to be moderating this because it's a very timely topic and because of the caliber, intellectual and other caliber, of our panelists and our speaker today. And I can personally say I've known and worked with each of these people for many years and am pleased and appreciative that they're with us, and I'm honored to be speaking with them. Before introducing our speaker, let me just sort of go through the order of combat, if you will. As you all know, and as Herb said, Ed Green has published a remarkable paper on the Society's website, and we're going to invite Ed to the podium shortly to give you a synopsis of it. After doing that, I will introduce more fully my panelists, Elise Walter, I will say, not Walker, Alan Beller and Craig Beezer, and ask them to say a few words on their perspectives on Ed's remarks in his paper. I will then ask them to pose some questions to Ed and discuss issues with Ed, and I will, at the end of our appointed time, blow the whistle and referee the process in between. I should say at the beginning that our comments are our own comments and not the Society's. The Society should be given credit for giving us this opportunity, but not blamed for what we may choose to do with it. And I know each one of the individual speakers would like to say that their comments are theirs and not their own organizations. So without any objections to this order of business, let me start with some background as to the topic and how we came with our speaker. The program was developed by the Society's Division of Corporation Finance Committee. And let me say for a minute a word of credit to my co-members on that committee, Mickey Beach, Paul Belvin, Justin Klein, Bill Morley, Peter Romeo, Dick Rowe, and Elise Walter, all alums from the Division of Corporation Finance and have put in a lot of work over the last year. We did start thinking about this program about a year ago, and at that time we had a number of logical subjects that we figured might be passé by this year, a year later at this time, such as executive compensation or option granting practices or corporate governance. We were less clear about what our subject should be as we were clear about what it shouldn't be. And I think it was to our great good fortune that we reached out to Ed Green to test drive an idea for this program, to which Ed gave us full support, enthusiastic support, and was volunteered to write this paper and be with us today. And I must say, a recent view of the calendar and the headlines and news events shows us just how prescient Ed was and how right we were to have followed his support for this program. In the last several months, the chairman and each commissioner, the chief economist, the division director of the Division of Corporation Finance, and other senior SEC staff have all spoken, significantly spoken, about the need to seek some kind of conjunction in global securities regulation. Just recently, the U.S. Treasury Department, including the Secretary, have spoken about initiatives that would lead to the modernization of the U.S. regulatory system, particularly with respect to global matters. If you just read your email inboxes to see the topics at seminars and current events, you'll see that this topic is now the headliner on many, many programs, and the airwaves have been filled with additional articles, additional to Ed's, speaking about this, including by senior SEC staffers. So the time is right, and with this as a backdrop for this this program and the timeliness of the topic, let me just say a word or two about our speaker and then bring him up to the podium for you. In introducing Ed, it's a great pleasure for me personally, because he was the division director when I joined this agency in Corporation Finance in 1980. And since then has been a real mentor, personally and intellectually, to me. So it's my pleasure to introduce him. His career has been one of energy, imagination, and excellence. At the commission, after serving as division director, he was the general counsel to the agency. He went on to pursue a very distinguished career in private law practice with Cleary, Gottlieb, Steen, and Hamilton. And he spent many years overseas, both in the Tokyo and London offices for Cleary Gottlieb. And more recently, he has left private practice and has become the general counsel of City Markets and Banking of Citigroup, Inc. Throughout his career, Ed has been a prolific speaker and author, particularly with respect to global financial markets. And we are very fortunate that he has published his paper with the Society and that he's willing to be with us today. Please welcome our finest alumnus from Corp Fin and one of the agency's most distinguished alums, Ed Green.
Thank you, David, for those kind remarks. And I'm to alert you that if Chairman Cox does arrive, I'll stop and let him come up, and we will then resume. But let's get started. Cross-border capital markets activity has increased dramatically in recent years. This recent increased activity has caused market participants to focus on two issues. First, what makes one financial center more attractive than another in attracting cross-border business? Second, what's the appropriate model for regulating cross-border activities? I'd like to today focus on the second issue, in particular, how we should regulate offerings by companies raising capital internationally outside their home market. In my paper that David referred to, which has been posted, I propose to allow large European issuers to make public offerings using documents prepared in accordance with the European Union's Prospectus Directive. Today, I advocate that a moderate respect for the power of disclosure and market forces supports permitting these large issuers to make these offerings in the United States without having them registered. My proposal is based on the following assumptions: that it is in U.S. investors' interest to diversify their portfolios by investing in foreign securities, that for a variety of reasons there will be fewer registered public offerings in the United States by foreign private issuers, and that even if the proposals to be discussed at the SEC roundtable next week that Ethiopis Defar has organized, even if those proposals are adopted, which would be mutual recognition of exchanges and broker-dealer access to the U.S. to sell foreign securities, U.S. resident investors will still not have access to primary distributions, even offshore, because there's no exemption from Section 5 of the 33 Act if they participate. Thus, I recommend we should permit public offerings by large European Union issuers in the United States without registration, perhaps with a further condition that the regulator from the home market have an MOU in place with the SEC. A significant part of global capital raising today consists of offerings made across borders privately in what we call the wholesale market. While there's not uniformity with respect to which investors are eligible to participate in private placements, the status of privately placed securities, or how investors can be solicited, it's fairly straightforward to raise capital privately, especially in the U.S. with the development of the Rule 144A market, which is one of the great innovations that the staff and the Commission implemented. But with respect to raising money publicly, the traditional model has been one of national treatment. Public offerings in the United States must be registered and a U.S. prospectus prepared. The rules are the same with respect to foreign companies and U.S. companies, with some very small concessions made to foreign companies. Now, there are two other approaches, in addition to national treatment, that we need to consider for regulating cross-border offerings. One is mutual recognition. The other is to rely on disclosure and market forces with respect to offerings by companies of a certain size. With mutual recognition, the host country relies on the rules of the home country for doing a public offering, including context of disclosure documents, stabilization, and advertising rules. In addition to the liability regime of the home country, the offering materials would in most proposals be subject to the fraud rules of the host country as well. Mutual recognition typically requires a determination that the home country's regulatory and enforcement approach is comparable or at least consistent with that of the host country. An example in which that determination was made was the U.S.-Canadian multi-jurisdictional disclosure system, which is still in place. Now, the SEC has scheduled a roundtable next week, as I mentioned, to explore mutual recognition in two areas with implication for cross-border offerings: mutual recognition of home country regulation of foreign brokers and stock exchanges. My proposal is a compatible supplement to this initiative, and I would hope that we could integrate the three as we decide how to urge the Commission to go forward. A difficulty with mutual recognition is that it can be politicized. In the European Union, with the adoption of the Prospectus Directive and international financial reporting standards, prospectus content in public offerings is substantially equivalent to what one would produce in the United States today, and will be all the more so once the roadmap with respect to international financial reporting standards is completed. But there are 27 countries in the EU with 27 separate regulatory regimes, some with more resources and vigor than others. While prospectuses and public offerings must be vetted by the home country, the level of that vetting may vary. If we were to explore mutual recognition with the EU, would it be on a country-by-country basis or EU-wide? I think there would be concern with respect to the latter approach, EU-wide, because of the diversity of the countries involved. But then how do we decide that one home country in the EU is eligible but not another? Would we be willing to make distinctions between, say, the UK, Portugal, Germany, or Poland? Since the requirements for disclosure in connection with an offering are generally the same throughout Europe now, this would be a judgment directly about the effectiveness of the regulator's oversight. But I'm not sure we have to get into a situation that we have to make that judgment, because an alternative approach to mutual recognition of individual EU countries might be to rely on a combination of disclosure, market forces, the legal context created by the recent EU Financial Services Action Plan legislation, and perhaps an MOU between the SEC and the home country regulator, and have that in place with respect to large, well-followed companies wishing to raise capital in the United States. The SEC itself has recognized that well-known seasoned issuers, what we call WKSIs, should have access to the market without prior review of their offering documents, because these issuers, well followed in the market, do not require as extensive staff review with smaller companies. A significant rationale of the mutual recognition initiatives being discussed next week at the roundtable is that U.S. investors are being disadvantaged by restrictions in place which make it difficult for them to acquire foreign securities. The contemplated remedy is to permit financial intermediaries that are subject to appropriate foreign regulations to offer U.S. investors access to foreign securities. That's a recognition of the fact that these purchases can be made in the secondary market today, even if not as efficiently as would be the case if these proposals were adopted. But if secondary market purchases of foreign securities from financial intermediaries benefiting from mutual recognition would be permissible under this approach, one could ask, why not direct purchases and primary offerings, particularly by large, well-followed issuers? I would propose to allow such issuers to conduct distributions in the United States without requiring SEC registration. Because if we don't, even if the proposals I referred to be discussed at the roundtable were adopted, issuers still would not permit U.S. resident investors to participate in offshore primary offerings because that participation might violate Section 5 of the Act. We need to rethink our approach here in the U.S. given the discussion on competitiveness. U.S. investors currently have access to foreign securities in the secondary market without any restriction at all. Moreover, technology makes such investments much, much easier today than they were years ago when I was at the Commission. But under our current regulatory approach, retail investors in the U.S. can't purchase in an initial offering, even if they're interested in doing so, onshore or offshore, unless it's registered. We don't permit them to make investments in public offerings based on non-conforming documents, even with disclosure as to risks and identification of differences between what the U.S. requires and what the home country might require. Moreover, to the extent they do acquire securities of a foreign issuer offshore in secondary market trades, their ability to bring a claim for fraud under U.S. law is by no means certain. But why not experiment? Why not allow unregistered offerings to be made publicly in the U.S. with respect to certain companies if the disclosure is comparable? And if you think of it, this approach is an extension of the current practice, but to a wider group of investors. Today, we allow foreign companies to conduct what are de facto public offerings in the United States to qualified institutional investors relying on Rule 144A. From 1999 through the first half of 2006, 94% by value of global IPOs that did not list in the United States included a Rule 144A tranche. There are no restrictions on shares purchased in Rule 144A offerings. They're freely tradable in the home market after the offering. And without regulation requiring any particular disclosure, market forces have settled on documentation that is the same as that used in the home country with minor exceptions. So if we permitted what are in fact public offerings to institutional investors, why not consider expanding the universe of those eligible investors? And if we do consider expanding it, who should we include? There are two alternatives that I've been thinking about quite a bit recently. One would be European Union WKSIs being allowed to conduct non-registered public offerings in the United States using home country offering materials prepared in accordance with the requirements of the Prospectus Directive. The criteria would be similar to those we use for WKSIs here in the U.S., that is, $700 million of equity outstanding in the public held by non-affiliates. Of course, these companies would be subject to the home country liability regime as well as the U.S. anti-fraud rules if they were to conduct an offering in the United States. Just like their counterparts in the U.S., European WKSIs are well followed in the market by analysts, generally have a global investor base, have appropriate incentives to make full, fair, and timely disclosure, and their offering documents under the Prospectus Directive would be equivalent to what U.S. companies prepare. Because of the comparability of disclosure and the convergence of the U.S. and the EU markets, I would allow these companies to sell to any U.S. investors with appropriate disclosure of risks and differences in liability regimes. And even though not registered, one has to keep in mind that U.S. brokers can only recommend suitable investments to their clients. and issuers would still bear the risk of liability under Rule 10b-5. But then the question is, well, why not let these EU WKSIs use their home country offering documents but still require a registration statement to be filed with the SEC? That's the approach we took in the Canadian multi-jurisdictional system. In my view, registration would be a disincentive for European WKSIs to raise capital publicly in the U.S. First, it would subject them to a number of U.S. requirements that may be duplicative or inconsistent with the home country regime. Secondly, the U.S. prospectus liability regime and our litigation environment would be a deterrent, especially since these companies already have full access to the Rule 144A public market. And if we don't adopt my approach, issuers will still not let U.S. resident investors participate in primary offerings, even if the proposals to be discussed next week at the roundtable are adopted. The European Union rules on disclosure liability in connection with such an offering by European WKSIs and Rule 10b-5 potential liability should be, in my view, sufficient to protect U.S. investors. I believe the value of U.S. prospectus liability in this situation to investors is marginal. And building on the experience of the 144A market, which is a wonderfully efficient market, I can't emphasize that enough, we could also consider WKSI equivalents from any part of the world. Here, though, one might want to limit the eligible investor class to those with investment experience in the region or industry, as opposed to focusing on net worth, which is the typical approach we've taken for accredited investors. This is the approach that's been taken, for example, by the UK FSA, which permits private customers of financial intermediaries who have sufficient knowledge and understanding, focusing on knowledge and understanding rather than net worth, to be classed as intermediate customers, which means they have less regulatory oversight. I would not limit access to primary offerings by WKSIs, just institutions. There are many U.S. individual investors who are sophisticated, but who are today forced to invest only in the secondary market. Clearly, this proposal is controversial. But so was shelf registration when we started it 25 years ago. Markets are converging. There is not a race to the bottom, but a race to optimality, as reflected by the fact that many markets, for example, have implemented many portions of Sarbanes-Oxley, notwithstanding the rap that Sarbanes-Oxley has taken recently. And we must keep in mind that there are alternatives for many companies raising capital. There have been fewer new public offerings in the United States by foreign private issuers, and I do not think that trend will change. Perhaps then we should try an experiment. Let's start with European WKSIs in a pilot program, then consider whether to extend it to other companies. And to encourage regulatory cooperation, perhaps condition this pilot program on the European Union home country in which the issuer is located, having an MOU in place with the SEC. And with that, I will turn it over to my fellow panelists for searing critique.
Ed, thank you very much. Now we're going to have a change in the agenda because SEC Chairman Christopher Cox has been able to join us probably for a short time. Would you be able to say a few words to us?
Well, I'm going to go with the flow of this program. I want to make sure that everything stays on track. First of all, welcome to all of our panelists. This is a very, very distinguished panel. Ed's done a great job of kicking us off. Second, welcome to everyone here, and thank you all for joining us in the SEC's auditorium for what is, I think, a wonderful idea that the Historical Society has had here to host this discussion as part of the commemoration of the SEC's 73rd year. It's a sunny day outside, and we're air-conditioned inside, so we immediately see some differences between us and 73 years ago. Certainly no facility like this was available at the time of the founding of the SEC, when not only government's efforts to restore confidence in the economy, but things like Yankee slugger Merle Hogue and his feat of six singles in one game were drawing a lot of attention were the order of the day. That impressive feat and every public performance in those days was performed in a facility that had absolutely no climate control. So we have a lot to be grateful for these days in Washington, D.C. In those days, fans and athletes cooled off in other ways, such as by eating ice cream. And that the SEC Historical Society also has in store for us as part of this well-planned program. So we've got a large cool room on a hot summer day and also ice cream immediately following the more substantive part of the program. I am sure that Ed and our panelists will do at least the equivalent of hitting six singles in one game, possibly even hit a home run if you can help us to sort out the discrepancies in all the world's various regulatory regimes. Considering the history of the SEC's three quarters of a century necessarily puts us in a milieu of many different things, societal developments that have taken place over the intervening decades. It was 10 years to the day of the founding of the SEC that the Allies launched the invasion at Normandy that led to the liberation of Europe. With the end of the war came the end of the Depression, and the post-war years as a consequence of the bravery of those Rangers that scaled the cliffs and all the other Americans who fought with them were filled with great confidence. Americans turned their historic efforts to working in peacetime to extend the sphere of free minds and free markets. And even through the tensions of the Cold War that followed, America was by and large in a celebratory mood because we had much to celebrate, including especially the successes of sustained government policies through Democratic and Republican administrations, promoting the free flow of investment in our capital markets, built on a foundation of investor protection that became the model for the entire world. History's current has carried us through dramatic cultural changes as well that continue to this day. And in fact, it was on this date, June 6th, in 1955, that Bill Haley and the Comets reached number one on the hit parade with Rock Around the Clock. And exactly 5 years to the day later, also on June 6th in 1960, that Roy Orbison released Only the Lonely. So if you remember those songs, you will feel right at home during today's tour down the SEC's memory lane. We've all come here today because we appreciate the rhythms, the music, if you will, of the now global marketplace. Today's theme of Beyond Borders really does reach that essential point. As we near the end of the first decade of the 21st century and our markets continue to reach for new highs, the history of the SEC and of our markets now takes us everywhere in the world, into every time zone. And I think each of us is inexorably led to the notion that the future history of the SEC and of our global capital markets may well help literally billions of new people to reach previously unimagined levels of prosperity and individual freedom. It's not too much to hope that if we're successful in building such a world, not only prosperity, but peace among nations will be the result. As the 19th century French economist Frédéric Bastiat observed, where goods cannot cross borders, soldiers will. By ensuring the integrity of our worldwide markets, by taking our war against fraud and unfair dealing into the international arena, we at the SEC are doing the valiant work of peacemakers. It's true that much of our world remains disorderly and grim even while markets grow, but I don't think that observation fundamentally rebuts Bastiat. He surely would have recognized why some of our national differences, including differences in the regulation of trade and capital markets, must continue to exist while we do our best to reconcile them. Another great thinker, Alfred North Whitehead, offered in the last century what might be taken as a friendly corrective of Bastiat. Other nations of different habits, he said, are not enemies, they are godsends. Men require of their neighbors something sufficiently akin to be understood, something sufficiently different to provoke attention, and something great enough to command attention. We must not expect, however, all the virtues. Following that kind of enlightened thinking, the SEC, under the guidance of Ethiopis Tafara and the leadership of each of the divisions and offices of our agency, is working to develop a new framework for securities regulation in the global era, the very topic of this first panel, in which foreign stock exchanges, foreign broker-dealers, and foreign securities might all find a way to integrate with our own domestic system of regulation and investor protection. With this kind of consequential and hopeful vision laid before us, I'm eager to hear what each of our panelists has to say. You've gotten a good start without me, but I know that Ed and Alan and Craig and David and Elise, this wonderful panel brought together by the SEC Historical Society, are going to help us do this important thinking. There's a lot of thinking to be done on this exciting road ahead, so I hope that any headaches that you might feel later on in the afternoon are caused only by eating the ice cream too fast. Congratulations to all of you, to all of us in the SEC family on this celebration of our 73rd birthday, and many thanks to Carla and everyone at the SEC Historical Society for all of your fine work in organizing this event. With that, we ought to resume, as Ed says, delving into the details of the subject that the panel has got before it. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Chairman Cox. I think Ed has given us some ideas to think about and talk about, and Chairman Cox has warned us of the difficulties, the challenges in implementing those. Each of the panelists is here for a reason. They've thought, they've worked, they've discussed, they've considered international global finance in many different venues and contexts, and I'd like to introduce them and ask them each to say a word about the perspective that they bring to these issues. And Ed, you've already had your word, so we'll skip over you. But to your left, Alan Beller, a once and current partner at Cleary Gottlieb. Most of you know him. He's also the immediate former director of the Division of Corporation Finance. Alan's career has been storied and excellent in the international corporate finance and capital markets area, and he's written and thought a lot about this, and we'll look forward to his words. To my right, the next one to the left of you, is Craig Beezer, standing in for Mike McAlevey with General Electric. Craig and I have worked on global finance issues, and I was thrilled when Mike was diverted by another challenge at GE that Craig could step in and be with us on such very short notice. Craig is the Vice President, General Counsel, and Secretary of General Electric Capital and General Electric Capital Services. I think of him as essentially the general counsel to the corporate treasury at GE. And to my left, and the next person to your right, Elise Walter. Elise thinks of herself as a permanent regulator, I suppose, having been in the regulatory business since, I think, about 1977 when she came to the SEC. She's currently the Executive Senior Vice President for the NASD for Policy Affairs, Policy Matters. She was the Deputy of the Division of Corporation Finance and also did a sojourn at the CFTC where she was General Counsel. So can I start to my far right and ask Alan just to say a few words about his perspective on these issues before we engage Ed in some dialogue?
Yes, David, thank you. I do have some questions for Ed, but overriding observation about this proposal is that Ed's thought about opening a greater spectrum of our offering markets to non-U.S. WKSI-sized companies can't be examined in a vacuum that excludes how you also address the trading markets at the same time. It was Milton Cohen's genius back in 1966 to make us think about disclosure in the trading markets and the offering markets as integrated. Ed was actually here as director when the first giant steps in that direction, culminating in shelf registration, took place. I think Ed's question raises some really interesting proposals about, or questions about, what U.S. exchanges should be allowed to list and trade, if his proposal were to come to fruition in some form, and also relates to the questions about mutual recognition of foreign exchanges. I see Ethiopis in the audience, and his article and Ed's come together very much At that point, there's a roundtable a week from yesterday coming up that will address mutual recognition of exchanges. And I think what we're talking about today and at least that aspect of the mutual recognition discussion are very much integrally related. So that's kind of my perspective on this, and I'll reserve some thoughts for Ed for a few minutes from now.
Great. Craig?
Well, my perspective at GE Capital, and I should say my remarks should not be attributed to GE Capital or any member of the GE company family, but as a well-known season issuer here in the States, I think my approach to Ed's proposal is that it's a wonderful one as long as there's reciprocity for us. GE Capital to date has issued $18.5 billion U.S. equivalent of debt in Europe, and we also have, and that's approximately 39% of our overall debt issuance in 2007. We have domestic programs in Australia, Switzerland, Japan, also in Thailand as well. Those programs have been successful through concessions that we have negotiated with the applicable securities regulators. But a move toward a pilot program where there is reciprocity, well, where WKSIs are recognized here as well as overseas, would certainly help us as we move forward and drive home trying to issue more locally in the domestic markets, which is probably where our bent's going to be.
Thank you, Craig. Elise.
Thank you, David, who has committed the enormous faux pas of reminding people how long I've been a regulator and therefore how old I am. But moving on from that, I guess, as the dubbed regulator, although I must say there are some very powerful ex-regulators sitting to my right and to my left with whom I'm proud to share this table, but as the person in essence representing the regulatory point of view and the retail investor point of view, I guess I have a number of questions. I don't have answers, but I've got questions with respect to Ed's proposal, which comes either explicitly or implicitly with the notion of comparability. And when you look at what Ed has to say, it focuses on the regulatory principles, which, of course, are extremely important. But I think we also need to focus on implementation, interpretation, and enforcement. There's a very interesting study that was conducted at Indiana University last year, which analyzed the effect of insider trading laws on the marketplace and pointed out that the enactment of those laws really didn't have an impact on improving markets, but the enforcement of those laws decreased the cost of equity. And I think that points out in a rather precise way the fact that one can't really only look at these concepts in terms of regulatory requirements. So looking at things from the point of view of the retail investor, I think we need to worry about that. And we also need to worry about how much emphasis we're placing on disclosure of differences as really being the answer. I'm a little bit worried about comparability as an explicit determination because I think it will be widely misunderstood.
That finishes the opening statements. Now,
could I comment on?
I would like you to jump in, and I'm going to let Alan have at you.
Well, let's say three things. First, to Craig's point about reciprocity, that's, I think, fairly straightforward because the Financial Services Action Plan does allow on a country-by-country basis to make a determination you can rely upon home country documentation of its equivalent. And since IFRS and U.S. GAAP are going to be the same and the disclosure requirements are based on IOSCO's principles and for equity and soon for debt, that's going to be pretty straightforward. What you said, Elise, the disclosure is the same. The principles are the same. The question is going to be enforcement. And there, I think the focus ought to be to enhancing regulators' powers. IOSCO has been very innovative in trying to put forward two things. One is there's a multi-jurisdictional approach that regulators signed up to pledge cooperation. And secondly, to enhance powers that regulators have. And that comes up in the area of can you basically freeze assets on behalf of another regulator? Can you take action if there's alleged to be fraud? And that's important to the extent there is cross-border activity, that regulators be able to act on behalf of each other going forward. Also, some regulators, which I found to be fascinating, do not have the power to settle the way the SEC does. and therefore they have limited resources going forward in the context of looking at fraud. So I share your view, but I think we have to keep in mind that the disclosure documentation now with respect to these big companies is the same. There's going to be no difference between GE here and Deutsche Telekom in global markets. So the question is going to be, do we allow people to have access to those securities, to those markets, and if so, what should be the criteria? And I think if we focus on regulatory cooperation, and that's why I proposed that you have an MOU in place with the home country, at least it gives you, the New York Stock Exchange, and perhaps the SEC, access to a regulator if you are concerned about a cross-border fraud.
You're up, Alan.
Okay. The the hardest issues, I think, involved in mutual recognition relate to comparability. I do worry about the issue Ed raised, which is that comparability exercises may well become politicized. Ed's proposal, in a sense, to my way of thinking, is a very elegant attempt, and I don't mean that in any negative way at all, a very elegant attempt to sidestep the comparability issue by two things. One, driving to the EU standard of disclosure, which is certainly on the printed page comparable to the SEC system. And secondly, driving to this notion of going to the largest categories of issuers, non-US WKSI-sized issuers, arguing that the market is and the market following, institutional investor following, analyst following are as important governors of the quality of disclosure by those kinds of issuers as the regulators are. That certainly is a position which is consistent. It's not congruent, but it is certainly consistent with the position that was taken by the SEC when it adopted securities offering reform and set up the notion of immediate effectiveness and no review for WKSIs. The other moving part, though, in the matrix that I think allows you to think less hard or maybe to go less deep below sort of surface thresholds of foreign regulation in thinking about comparability is the universe of investors that you're going to open up a particular regime to. And there, Ed's proposal is, as he puts it, quite bold because it would go all the way down to retail investors without limitation. And it would go down to retail investors without registration. I don't think of registration as particularly a disclosure point because the MJDS is certainly precedent that you can have a registration regime that's based on home country disclosure. And you could have a registration regime that's based on EU disclosure and simply make them file an S-371, which is a cover sheet for whatever their prospectus directive disclosure looks like. I guess my question, all that by way of introduction, because there is a question coming at the end of that, which is, Ed, how would you feel about, and let me tell you, I mean, that more modest, less bold, but still pretty far-reaching disclosure, our proposal, home country disclosure, but to, and exactly what Ed has described, but, and you don't have to have both, either or both of registration for liability purposes, i.e. bring 11 and 12A2 into the regime, or two, at least for starters, go to a universe of investors that is well below the QIB definition but does not include my mother. Any thoughts about?
Well, the irony is, having created such a efficient market rule 144A, companies have full access to capital here and don't need a wider group of investors. If you had registration, you'd have to address two things. One, would you have all the consequences of registration applicable to foreign private issuers, which is subject to Sarbanes-Oxley type provisions?
Posit the answer to that for the moment is no.
And then secondly, I think in terms of the liability regime, investment banks will say, look, you have no need to, in a sense, go out to take on this liability risk, which is higher than the home country and in the litigation environment of the United States. So I think the problem is, yes, it will be available, but no, it won't be used because, again, the institutional market is so deep and liquid here, as you saw with respect to all the IPOs that didn't come. They're all here in some way, 144A. So the question is, do you want to really reach out on a pilot program and give U.S. retail investors access to certain foreign securities? Now, maybe I would be not uncomfortable starting with the test that said experience and knowledge. I'm not particularly a great fan of how we approach this in the U.S., which is not to focus on experience, but how much money you make. The theory is that if you're rich enough, you can still be stupid, but you can hire investors to go forward. Why not look to, in a sense, sophistication, experience, knowledge of sector, knowledge of markets to allow people to participate? That's a hard thing for broker-dealers to decide. They're going to have to make a determination, but they have to, at some extent, with respect to the suitability requirement. So if you wanted to start that way, I would say, fine, let's open it up to investors who can demonstrate they've got experience investing in that part of the world or that industry to give them choices. Because the reality is today they are investing cross-border in the secondary market. If you look at the holdings of U.S. investors and non-U.S. companies, it's grown dramatically in the last 10 years.
But your system, your proposal, works fine for us being recognizing people in this country. Is the EU the place to go to do this? Is the EU going to recognize WKSIs on a automatic effectiveness, automatic go-to-market system?
Well, in fact, yes, because the interesting thing about the Financial Services Action Plan, for the first time, it forced the SEC to negotiate with the EU, and negotiations took place because if you look at what the rules require, U.S. companies would have to reconcile their financial statements to international financial reporting standards. And that would be an interesting, ironic development. Well, that led to people sitting down at the table, and that's what the roadmap's about, and they've deferred the requirement of reconciliation. And secondly, the Financial Services Action Plan does contemplate that countries can make judgments that if the disclosure is equivalent based on the same IOSCO principles, you can use the home country disclosure documents. That's not going to be an issue because we've, in a sense, solved it with accounting. Because that's going to be the key issue. Once you've solved it for accounting, I can't emphasize enough, the disclosure standards in Europe and the U.S. are based on the same IOSCO principles for equity and will be with respect to debt because IOSCO is taking comments on that going forward. So for listing and for offerings, these world-class companies are going to basically have the same disclosure to the market. So the question is twofold. Should we basically rely upon home country review? And then what Alan has suggested, if you also let them offer securities in the U.S., well, why not let them trade securities in the U.S. without going through what you have to do today to get your securities listed on an exchange? If, after all, people have access to the German market, the French market, the UK market, and with respect to these companies, why not let them trade in the U.S. without any consequences attaching other than what would attach in the home market? It's controversial, I admit, but I think we're kidding ourselves because we just don't focus on the fact that cross-border activity continues to grow and there are no limitations on U.S. investors buying securities in a cross-border context. It's inefficient to perhaps do so, but you can.
Ed, does your proposal really contemplate that it's more important in principle than it is in practice? I mean, in a sense, retail investors don't have very good access to public offerings true retail investors in the United States because they're limited and they tend to go to other people. And in the end, aren't you in effect quarreling with the level at which the QIB standard not, perhaps wasn't initially developed, but where it is today?
Well, the QIB needs to be expanded. That market is, as I said, a public market, and the question is expanded. I don't see why we don't allow the retail chains we have with Smith Barney and with Dean Witter or whatever, if there are interesting offerings with globally held companies, why shouldn't they be allowed to participate? If you look at what happened with the privatizations when they came in the 90s to the U.S., there was quite a bit of U.S. interest in going forward. Because the real issue is this. Is it better to have a chance to participate in a primary offering, or do you always force the U.S. side to buy in the secondary market? And that's the question in terms of how deals are priced and what really going forward. And I think if you ask people, they would be interested in having a choice as to where to invest. But right now, they don't have the choice. It's only in the secondary market. And I will emphasize again, the U.S. kids itself, if it thinks it's going to have many, many foreign companies come to register in the U.S., it's not necessary. There will be some sectors. For example, some of the private Chinese companies in the high-tech area have found your market to be the best market for pricing. That will continue. But no state-owned Chinese company is going to come and list in the United States. And the same with privatizations in other markets around the world. Russian companies are not going to come to the United States. And yet those markets are active and buoyant. And the question is, do we want to have our investors have access? Indian markets are the same way. There's a huge pipeline of IPOs that are coming out of India, and very few are going to come to the U.S.
Let me just drop a footnote there that confirms that. Actually, when everybody reads about the state privatizations of the Chinese companies and why they won't come to the U.S., and the answer as to why they won't come to the U.S. has nothing to do with the U.S. regulatory regime. It has to do with the fact that they don't have to come to the U.S. To list anymore. When I went back to private practice last August, the thing that actually hit me over the head on this point had nothing to do with China. It had to do with the fact that I started talking to a couple of my partners. We were talking about a Latin American issuer and an IPO that was being done in Brazil. And it is now, I would say, commonplace for attractive companies coming out of Brazil. They can raise $4 billion in an IPO, including from the U.S. institutional investor community, $2 or $3 billion of those, with a listing in Sao Paulo and nothing else. No listing in New York, no listing in London, no listing anywhere. And that is a world that I'm not sure we've come to grips with in terms of our regulatory framework.
And what we could do if we didn't think we wanted to open up primary offerings under the terms I laid out, we could simply make easier access to the secondary market by the mutual recognition proposals we're discussing next week, or have these securities be able to trade freely in the United States without any consequences attaching to the companies whose securities trade. So why shouldn't your company be able to do an offering in Brazil but trade and list in New York? If you're comfortable with respect to companies of a certain size, that there's disclosure. I mean, the point is, why don't we try to make the markets a bit more efficient because it's happening, and we wake up to the fact that our national treatment model is not protecting people from going cross-border, and if there are going to be these developments that Alan suggested, let's try to be a little bit more imaginative to reduce some of the costs that are inherent in the system when you engage in cross-border activities.
From an EU perspective, do you think that there would be some pushback on the WKSI approach, given that the EU would like to be seen as one collective market, albeit there are the 27 member states, and we've encountered certain things from jurisdiction to jurisdiction that continue to differ? Would they be receptive and accepted, understanding the comments that you said before, and say, well, look, if you're going to accept some of our larger issuers, why not accept all of our issuers or some of our medium issuers?
That's a fair point. I think that because we have worked out, in my view, the congruence between international financial reporting standards and U.S. GAAP, and there's not going to be a requirement of reconciliation either market, that we'll be able to achieve that equivalence with respect to any U.S. company following U.S. rules.
I think Europe would accept that. McCreevy, my instinct would be, I'd be curious as to what Ethiopia's would think on it, but my instinct would be that that's not an issue. Because one of the interesting developments, I think, has been for the first time we've sat down and had some interesting discussions where we tried to get access for our companies and our financial institutions. The key thing was consolidated supervision, where the SEC really stepped up, because Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and Merrill Lynch would have had a very difficult time doing in business in Europe because their holding companies aren't regulated, which is required by the Financial Services Action Plan. So that was the first time there was, in a sense, bringing to the table with respect to a very important issue, and the SEC handled that very imaginatively. Very imaginatively. And it's made a real difference. The same with respect to IFRS and U.S. GAAP. Again, there were active and ongoing discussions, handled imaginatively on both sides. I think there's goodwill. There's very good relations that exist between the EU. Those two markets have integrated and become seamless, or enormous capital pools for investors. And I think what would happen if we adopted this approach, it would become a regulatory model for other markets as they develop. You look at what China's doing. Shanghai is going to be one of the largest stock exchanges in the world fairly soon. Singapore, Hong Kong are growing. Brazil, another market that's growing as well. Those markets, I think, will race to measure themselves against the EU and the US. So we're not going to have a race to the bottom. We're going to have a move toward optimality, as I mentioned in my talk. So I think if we can get a package together, we can enhance regulation with respect to developing markets in a way that would be positive for all of us.
Without delaying too much, but just to go back to the accounting issues, I mean, you sort of waved your hand and said, well, we'll fix IFRS and GAAP, and that's make it going to be all fine. But we still have a ways to go there. Do you see any major risks in that respect?
I don't think so. I think there's a goodwill on both sides to get that. I think the more interesting thing there is the suggestion that U.S. companies have a right to report under IFRS
right,
as well.
Right.
And if you think of it, you really ought to try to move toward one accounting system, which is international financial standards. I think many people are frustrated at U.S. GAAP because of its complexity. And so I think that would be a fascinating experiment. I'd be interested what you think, Alan, but if you both made the choice, and then secondly, do you think companies would follow? Because that would, in a sense, especially for large companies, give us truly global markets with comparable reporting under an agreed accounting system. Maybe idealistic, but it's something that one would hope we would move to.
Right. Challenges on the audit standards?
Those are going to be difficult, but again, Europe is moving and taking some steps to try to move audit standards closer to the U.S. Now, they'll never necessarily get there, and there'll always be people who will say that we're taking risks, but the point is, in these integrated markets, there's been effect of what we do in Europe and vice versa, and we can't forget that. I mean, the biggest challenge that Europe has is there's no single regulator, and politically that's not going to happen. And so you've got regulators in Bulgaria, Estonia, and elsewhere that you have to deal with on the same level, perhaps, as the UK, FSA, and so forth. But notwithstanding that, there has been an attempt, though there isn't one regulator, to have standards adopted by legislation or by directives that would enhance auditing, enhance independence of auditors, and move forward. Whether it's going to get to the U.S., probably not. But the question is it close enough that we should be comfortable? Then the issue for me is, well, why not rely upon disclosure with respect to differences in risk, as opposed to telling certain U.S. investors you can never invest unless people play by the U.S. rules? And that, to me, is the issue.
I find myself, I sound to myself like I'm speaking a little bit out of both sides of my mouth on the accounting question, not the auditing question for the moment. On the one hand, it seems to me, I agree with Ed, we're going in that direction. It's implicit, I think, in Ed's proposal that the SEC get to the end of the roadmap, or the end of the road on the roadmap, sooner rather than later. It's implicit in Ed's proposal that the EU do what I think they're going to do by 2009, which is to declare U.S. GAAP and IFRS, quote-unquote, equivalent, which is their standard. I think this doesn't work if you don't get there, because comparability, any definition of comparability and disclosure depends on accepting either one of these sets of auditing principles. The reason I feel like I'm talking a little bit out of both sides of my mouth is I don't think that convergence and comparability are the issues with respect to getting to the end of either of those roads. I think the issue is U.S. GAAP a comprehensive, trustworthy set of accounting principles that gives a true accounting picture of a company to a reasonably sophisticated investor, i.e. one who can read today's financial statements? And B, is IFRS a comprehensive, reasonably trustworthy set of accounting principles that allows a reasonably sophisticated investor to get a picture of a company? They don't have to be the same picture. They can be different pictures. That's why I'm not as fussed about convergence as I am about the standard that I just articulated. And on the other hand, I agree with Ed. Sooner or later, we ought to move globally to one set of accounting standards. That sure sounds like convergence over time. I'm not sure it is, in fact. I think it may just be that one withers away and the other survives without ever getting complete convergence. The folks in Norwalk might not necessarily like to hear this. I think if one withers away, it's more likely to be U.S. GAAP. I say that not because of quality. I say that because global market cap is going to move inexorably out of the United States over 10 or 20 or 25 years. So I do think it's an important element. I'd love to see and people in the building heard me say this when I was there, so that I'm not embarrassed to say it now. I'd love to see the SEC get to the end of the road in the roadmap before 2009. One reason is that I think the sooner the SEC does that, the sooner it seems to me that it can have an honest place at the table debating IFRS, and by honest, I mean, they're willing to play by those rules, and therefore, I think non-U.S. companies and regulators will resent less than they do now the SEC taking a view on IFRS. At the moment, I think it's a suboptimal position for the commission to be in. I think if they got to the end of the road and the roadmap, it would be better.
It is interesting that no other market has adopted U.S. GAAP, but that's not true with respect to international financial reporting standards. And as other markets develop and become more transparent and liquid, they will have accounting principles, and I think they're going to move toward international financial reporting standards and not U.S. GAAP, and that's going to put pressure on us to allow, I think, our companies to report on a comparable basis.
Can I swing you back to the auditing standards? Because it has always seemed to me that more important than the specific standards that are adopted, assuming that they meet a certain level of quality, is how they're enforced in the broadest sense and whether or not they're really being presented with integrity. And I think those issues are more difficult. We have a longer way to go and perhaps more important in the end.
But, if you look at WKSIs, they're all audited by four accounting firms. And that's it. And in some ways, that's a problem we have to address. But if you've got the four accounting firms, they are going to apply, I think, auditing standards on a fairly global basis going forward. But honestly, there is the views, but there's an absolute lock on auditing by the major firms, because global companies that are in multiple markets have to have credibility, and the credibility now is with the big four. So I'm not so worried about that. I think the harder question would be if you expand it to other companies and then you begin to have accounting firms that may not be as recognized. But I wouldn't start there. I want to start with companies like GE, but who are not U.S. but European or elsewhere. And those companies, I'm not, so, they're audited by KPMG or Pricewaterhouse or whatever.
So can we swing back to you, Craig, a minute? You've said your company's everywhere. If you were controlling the pen here and recognizing that no one's going to be knowing that they're right, would you have picked EU to do this pilot project, or are there other jurisdictions that you see as being potentially a good place to start?
I think the EU obviously presents certain challenges in this regard. Initially, I thought maybe we'd want to look to a different jurisdiction. Maybe look, our experience that we've had as a company in Japan has been very similar to what we've had here in the U.S., but I think in terms of a growing market and a bigger market going forward, that as we move toward what I think will be convergence between GAAP and IFRS, I think the EU probably is the best market for us to approach. But one question coming from that is, taking the point that maybe we will have convergence, do you think similarly with respect to a single regulator, may we ever get to that point with CSER maybe being interposed as the regulator since it's relied upon so heavily by the EC and the FSA and others? Do you think we'll ever get to that point?
I think that's the challenge. CSER is trying to fill that void and trying to come up with mechanisms so you have consistent interpretation of international financial reporting standards, because the real issue you have is not just the standards, but to the extent that they may be a bit more principle-based. You've got 27 different regulators who are overseeing their application, and that is the big concern. And that is also the issue that's been raised by some European companies. Well, if we come to the U.S., is the U.S. going to tell us how to apply? That's why John White has made a distinction between interpretation, which it will not get into, but application, which it will. He's been quite clear about that, that they will defer to CSER and work with CSER to come up with common interpretation. But we need to have better mechanisms to be sure that we have consistent application, because there's there are 27 countries with a wide range of experience. Again, that's why, though, I'm comfortable starting with very large companies, because they will tend to come from the most mature economies and the larger countries in the EU.
For Ed or Elise or others, there's a sort of a back-to-the-future element of this debate. If you go back to the late 80s and read the commission literature and the rulemaking, it sounded as if they were reading Ed's article today when they spoke about a bilateral relationship with Canada and the multi-jurisdictional disclosure system. What have we learned from that system that we should take forward? What have we learned about that system that we should ignore and fix in the future?
I'll defer to Elise. She knows more about that than I do.
Oh, no, never. But I think that was a noble experiment that didn't go very much of anywhere, as we can all agree. It was intended at the time that we did it to be an experiment to be expanded over the course of time, and that happened neither with respect to the countries nor with respect to the principles embodying it. But it is interesting because it is the only real live example that's out there, albeit with different bells and whistles and much heavier bells and whistles, that really embodies this principle. So I think there are certainly things to be learned from it, both in terms of the fact that it was tried, and to go back to what is necessary and what is not necessary. And to me, you have to come back to, once again, I think I've talked about this before, come back to questions of interpretation and enforcement, and also questions of liability. And I do think the liability issues are particularly important in the primary offering context because of the heavy burden of liability in this country. And once we lift those liabilities for foreign companies, there certainly is a very cogent argument that they should be lifted for American companies as well, which may lead you back to the drawing board in terms of the liability structure.
But careful, we're not lifting liability. We're saying that home country liability would be applicable as well as host country fraud rules. And most EU home countries do have liability regimes with respect to offering, not as rigorous as the U.S., but it's there. So it's not just the anti-fraud. You'd have the home country liability, which U.S. courts could apply. I think with respect to the Canadian experiment, the perception of other countries was the U.S. wanted the Canadian system to be so close to the U.S. that it really was equivalent, and there were changes that were put in place to make it work. That coupled with the fact that there has to be registered and Section 11 liability is just not attractive to the U.K. or other countries who were considering it, because no other country came forward and said, gee, this is great for Canada, why not put it in place for us? to my knowledge, I don't know whether you may have had discussions behind the scenes.
And clearly at the time, I mean, even with more flexibility, there wasn't a great deal of interest on the part of any other country. There was considerable time and attention spent to thinking about the UK, but it never really got off the ground in any way, shape, or form.
Well,
I think Lisa hit the issue, and it's liability. And the question is, should we say, look, just do it the way we did it in Canada and file a registration statement or not? And and maybe it's a practical approach. I don't think that's going to be particularly attractive. And so I'm prepared to take an experiment, and maybe if we are going to go that way, maybe limit the investors not to everyone, but to have some level of sophistication so that disclosure with respect to differences in risk is something you have some level of confidence in. And that's where I think the debate ought to be. But we ought to come up with something that's realistic. But we have to keep in mind that we have a very public market today for non-registered offerings. And that's going to continue, and there's because of the 144A market, which is, as I said, one of the most remarkable things that you and Linda did was to create, in a sense, what we, yes, we know it's a private place, but it's a public market. It's marketed, and it's approached, and it acts as if it really were a public market, but it's institutional only. And now my question is, can't we expand that? We're halfway there already. Why not increase the number of investors who can participate? Less debate there, but we don't require 144A offers to be registered. And the disclosure in the market has really created very sophisticated disclosure. The documents are very comparable to what you see in a public offering. So maybe steps there and go increment and decide how you want to expand it, because why deny everyone other than major institutional investors access to some of these attractive offerings?
I just want to come back and emphasize a little bit the distinction that you pointed out, which I think is really important, which is a distinction between liability and access to the dispute resolution system, the court system in this country, because I think to force U.S. investors into a foreign jurisdiction's court system is very much too much of a burden. But to draw a distinction between that and liability, I think, makes some sense.
One of the issues would be whether if you had this type of system, and Alan and I have talked about this, whether you would say, well, we'd permit you access, but you'd have to consent to be sued in the United States. And Alan reminded me that in the context of when Rule 144A was being considered, the staff considered but decided not to recommend that going forward because of a concern it would make the market less attractive. And so I did not put that into my proposal. I had initially thought about it, but talking to Alan, he persuaded me that we didn't need it because you still will have access to courts because if you're doing an offering in the U.S., it's just that our courts will take jurisdiction with respect to that offering. But I'd be interested in Alan's views on
it. Yeah. I guess my view on the consent point is that if a security is being offered into this country, let's leave the mutual recognition of foreign broker-dealers out of this discussion for just one moment. But if it's a U.S. broker-dealer offering these securities to a U.S. investor, jurisdiction over some deep pocket will lie, whatever the substantive law that applies. And that was my particular reason for coming out where I did on the consent. I think it would have been a near fatal element of the 144A proposal. I think it's the 144A's use would have been much, much less than it has turned out to be, and I think the same thing would happen here. And yet, I don't think the practical consequences of it are all that significant. I was actually listening to Elise and Ed and thinking slightly differently. I mean, we do have this odd tension in our system, and it's always been harder to deal with in terms of how the Commission treats non-U.S. issuers. The deregistration proposal, I think, interestingly stakes out a particular. It's not a proposal anymore. The final outcome of the deregistration rules stakes out a particular position, which is it's where you're listed that ought to determine the regulatory regime that you operate under, unless you elect some other regulatory regime. And that is consistent with the the way the Exchange Act operates and the way the SEC has administered the Exchange Act and the secondary trading markets. And as Ed points out, retail investors can buy any old thing in the world they want without triggering either U.S. disclosure requirements or the U.S. Securities Act liability regime. And the question is, why should it be different for a primary offering? And there's a policy answer to that question, which is if the company's out there raising money, it has a higher standard, arguably, under which it should operate. Secondly, there's an historical reason, which is that Section 5 is out there sitting like the elephant in the room. And Ed's proposal is a very broad stroke at just, you know, throwing the elephant out the window. That's a hard thing, I think, for maybe I just left the job more recently than Ed did, and so I'm more worried about it. But I think that's a hard thing for the commission to do. I agree it's bold, and I agree it would kind of get you to a place that's consistent with the secondary trading market, but what do you do with the statute? And I guess I'd ask Ed, what do you do with the statute? Do you just decide it doesn't, you know, it's a historical anomaly and the commission has exemptive authority and away we go?
Yeah, the interesting thing is that where I now work, I am absolutely agnostic on this issue because we will raise money globally for our clients. But I've been thinking about the fact that I'm not sure we're taking it seriously, the fact that these other markets are growing, that we need to rethink our regulatory approach. Yes, there's the exemptive authority. And if you do it, as we suggested, as a pilot program with large companies, it's controversial perhaps, but it's a start. But again, it's not going to affect where Citigroup or Goldman Sachs or Merrill Lynch does business. It just doesn't affect us. We'll live with our system if you don't change it, or we'll live with it if you do change it, because we can raise money globally in the U.S. and for clients. But I think it's important that the Commission engage in this debate. And what prompted my thinking was that we were starting with secondary market trading and making that more easy. That's the mutual recognition with respect to broker-dealer access and exchanges. But we weren't talking about what's the real issue, in my view, is access to offerings going on globally today in which U.S. people aren't participating other than institutionally. So I would link the three together to create with some efficiencies and do a pilot program, and then we'll see what happens. Now, there's risks here, and the risk is the first company that's a fraud that's come into our company that hasn't been registered, there will be a congressional inquiry, and the question is, do we have the courage to say there's always going to be some fraud? We can't ferret everything out, but we've got a rational system that helps investors, because if you accept the literature, people are saying you really need to have diverse portfolios, and U.S. investors probably have less diversity than others at a certain level. So if that's – and that's – in fact, that's the rationale for Ethiopia Stafara's article. Wasn't it that necessarily that you didn't have to worry about investor protection, but that diversity of portfolio was as important, and we needed to facilitate access to foreign securities with respect to U.S. investors. And we did that through exchanges having presence in the U.S. and broker-dealers being able to do business abroad, doing what? Selling only foreign securities. So I go the next step and say, well, and the problem is that the Commission's always been worried about this issue with exchanges, and that is, well, gee, we're going to let people buy in Germany, but what if they're buying in a public offering? Corp Fin has been very, very opposed to the idea of having exchanges have access to the U.S. without registering, because the idea was, well, gee, they can't buy it in the U.S. because it's not registered, but what if they're buying in a registered offering offshore, and if some of these offerings may be done on exchanges, how do we protect ourselves? So it's that kind of thinking that, in a sense, has really dominated how at least Corp Fin has approached this issue. I think it's time to perhaps revisit it.
Yeah. I do think any version of your proposal, and this goes back to what I said at the beginning, any version of your proposal forces the Commission, and in fact I think it's both Market Reg and Corp Fin, to change their thinking about both foreign exchanges in this country and what U.S. exchanges ought to be allowed to list.
Absolutely right. And increasingly, we're going to have consolidation of exchanges, and with electronic trading, we're going to basically, in a sense, technology is going to allow you to trade anywhere around the world.
Right. You were talking about Citi. I'm going to ask you to put your Citi hat on for purposes of this question, which is, if you were to do something like this, would let's say Citi's the book running lead in a big WKSI. U.S., a non-U.S. WKSI U.S. offering under the new regime. Will Citi, in fact, tap its retail network and sell securities in this offering, or will this be another party to which no one comes?
First, as none of us here speak for our organization, I speak for myself. I think what would happen would be that one would start slowly, and we would basically look at criteria with respect to these investors. Most retail firms basically categorize their clients with respect to sophistication, what they can invest. I mean, the fascinating thing was, ironically, how few people were eligible to invest in Google when it came public. Now, it strikes me that when you act that way, you're really, in a sense, protecting people who don't necessarily need to be protected against themselves. But I think we go cautiously. But my guess is there are lots of people who would like to invest generally. And the interesting thing is that if other products begin to develop, we're talking about individual securities, but what about exchange-traded funds? Those are going to develop in Europe as well to give you exposure to indices or to composites. Same issue comes up. So as we begin to develop more sophisticated products that give you exposure and diversity, shouldn't we at least have a little bit more flexibility as to what you can do if you would like to diversify your portfolio?
So I'd like to ask you one last question to put you on the spot and sort of wrap it up around this. I mean, if I'm at the commission hearing all this from you, I wonder why I don't put all my energies into fixing the accounting situation, pushing for continued convergence on auditing standards, worrying about mutual recognition for brokers and exchanges, and leave this gnarly offering issue alone until I see how the other things come out. Why should the commission be working harder on this particular point?
Well, because I think it's intellectually what ought to, it's part of a package. I think you can't address one without addressing the other, because ironically, all you're going to be doing there is basically facilitating cross-border trading. And you say, well, that's fine, relying on the disclosure, but you're not, in a sense, addressing the real question, well, what's the difference between the cross-border access versus a primary market asset? You've got to debate that issue. You may decide it's not worth doing, or that you won't give up certain protections, such as registration, but it's part of the same process. I do find it kind of ironic that that's what we're focusing on, and we're going to facilitate this cross-border trading. And what are we telling retail investors? Oh, that's okay, because you can rely on disclosure and everything else. But you can't rely on disclosure if you want to buy it directly. So, I mean, I just think that's, shelf registration, when we did it, almost never made it, because people weighed in and said, this is terrible. Diligence is going to fall away. It's going to transform how our markets. It's going to lead to domination of certain investment banks. I mean, SHAD was lobbied to thunder before the rules finally went effective, and we had the courage to go forward, and it was an absolutely profound change in the capital markets, and it spread throughout the world. And now's the time, in my view, for the Commission to put these issues and at least have a debate and a dialogue. Maybe not do it, but let's have a wider debate than we've had to date.
Anybody else want to get a word in edgewise on my panel? Well, why don't I see if we can close in style first by thanking Ed very, very much, not only for the work that went into your paper, but also to subjecting yourselves to our infuriating questions with you here today. You're great to be with us, Ed, and I appreciate it, and the society appreciates it. I'd also like to thank my co-panelists, Elise Walter and Craig Beezer and Alan Beller, for being with us today. Great minds thinking with Ed. It was wonderful to be here. Another thanks to the Corporation Finance Committee that helped put this on, Mickey Beach, Paul Belvin, Bill Morley, Peter Romeo, Dick Rowe, Elise Walter, and Justin Klein. Thank you very much for your hard work. And I remind you again that this program and Ed's paper are posted on the Society's, will be posted on the Society's website. I've been told that Ed's paper has already been visited by quite a few people, and when the transcript and the rest of this is ready, we'll put this program up. And as was mentioned earlier, every year we have our annual meeting at about the same time as the SEC's birthday, and this is the 73rd one, and we would like to invite everybody in the audience, everybody outside the doors waiting for us to join us in celebrating the SEC's birthday at an ice cream social. Thank you very much.
Thank you.